Hi, it's Dan here for Dusty Discs Radio, and this is the podcast Liner Notes, revealing chats with Canada's retro music makers. Today, I'm very honored to have as my special guest music impresario, Bill Riley, best known as band manager for the 60s bands The Churls and The Fringe. And we'll be talking about his many musical adventures, and we'll get some insights into the Canadian music scene from someone who's been part of it since the 1960s. So thanks for joining me today, Bill. How are you?
I'm just peachy. Not bad for an old guy, huh?
Since the 60s. Holy guacamole. We're talking more than a half a century now.
Yeah, but I was just a baby then. I mean, don't forget. I was walking the streets in diapers.
There you go. So were you born in Southern Ontario?
No, I was born in England, actually.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering about that. So you got into the, you ended up obviously in Southern Ontario at some point in your early life?
Yeah, it's kind of a long story that we don't have time
yeah,
for.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, but I did get here with my mother only, just that was the only family that came. And I was sort of dumped unceremoniously, whether I liked it or not, into Guelph, at a friend's place for her. And then I got fed up with all that after a while and headed for Toronto, and that's where it all began.
Isn't that interesting? Well, I was born in Guelph.
Really?
That's my hometown, yeah, in 1960.
Wow.
So my parents, all my family, there's still a lot of family back there, actually.
Yeah.
So
that was a nice town, no question about that. Apparently, my mother's friend, who I didn't know anything about in England, had come over here to be a part of a Guelph's girls' school that was up on the hill there on Highway 24. She was kind of one of those guards for the wayward girls. She and my mother bought a house in Guelph in the suburbs that had just been built, a brand new one, out in the suburbs. So she was invited to come and live here in this new country, and that's how we arrived.
Well, interesting, because there's lots of, you know, ex-Brits over here. My grandfather, my great-grandfather was born in England, and then my grandfather was born here in Brighton, Ontario. So I'm on the West Coast now, but that's my pedigree as well from back there. So you got yourself into the music biz somehow. Did you try to play music, or were you just always into just being around bands? And
well, yeah, I did try to play. I wasn't very successful. I actually played a pretty fair piano because my mother, at a very young age, demanded I learn. So in came this studious old lady that used to come once a week, and we had one of the old Victorian upright types pianos. Well, the house was a Victorian house anyway, apparently built in 1897. And we had this old piano in there, and she'd come in and try and teach me all these chords and runs and whatever. And when she left, I kind of blew a at her and did my own thing and found out how to do it myself. So
there
I pretty much played by ear.
Yeah.
And that kind of helped me out, because later on in life, I was able to play the B3 and that kind of thing.
Nice. Well, you know, it is a combination. Some people talk about their formal training, and that's great and everything, but other people just have a feel for it, and they figure out what sounds good, and they do that. And so my old manager always used to say, everybody wants to be part of the music business. So was there a point where you realized, well, I'm not going to be a player. I just want to be involved in promoting or...
Not really. I just sort of did that because I was more or less forced to do it on this piano. And by the time we got to Canada, I'd never even considered it. My main thing was to get a job and try and earn a living, because the demand of the house was that I contribute or else get out.
Yes,
so
there you go.
I had to contribute. So I did the whole looking for jobs, get a job, lose a job, get another one, lose a job. You know, life went on.
But
eventually I got fed up of being in Guelph and going through that garbage, and decided to move to the, quote, big city,
where
the opportunities were greater. However, they weren't.
Well, so
life went on.
So what year would that have been that you moved to Toronto?
Gee whiz, you're really going to date me, aren't you, Dan? that would have been 1960. You mean when I got to Toronto, or when I did the band thing?
Yeah, when you got to Toronto, mid-60s.
When I got to Toronto, it would probably be about 61, early 62, something like that.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and then I sort of hunted around for jobs and had a couple of thousand on them, I guess, along the way. I'll tell you why, really, because you may or may not want to know, but my mindset was one of freedom. It always was, because over and above living in the house in England, I failed to mention because nobody asked, we also had a 200-acre farm. So I was a young farm kid from the age of about 10 learning to ride a tractor or drive the tractor and do all the usual farm chores and milk cows and all that nonsense. And I went through school actually to become a vet. So that all happened in England. So I had that thing of freedom. I never wanted to be cooped up in the quote 9-to-5 system of government jobs. And I just couldn't bear with it. So basically all the jobs I got, I would last anywhere from 2 hours to 2 months, depending on what it was. I just couldn't handle being in a building, told to punch a time card and leave at 5 o'clock and go to the bathroom at 12. It wasn't me.
So yeah, fair enough. I'm with you, brother. I'm with you because you want to live your life, right? I'm not giving my life to somebody else.
That worked, you know. Yeah. So that's what got me to the village in around early 1966. I just literally, as did many, dropped out of society per se, as it was, and just said, to hell with this 9-to-5 thing and going to work every day all dressed up in a suit. And I had some really good jobs, mind you, along the way, but I didn't like any of them that much. But so that's what happened. I came to a conclusion one day that this wasn't for me. And as it coincidentally happened, it was a happening thing in Toronto's village at that time, early 65, 66. And I was then drawn to all the music and the bands, and that's how that all became a thing.
Well, you obviously got yourself into the scene, and then I see you made friends with David Clayton Thomas and some of the other people that were around at that time. So you found your way. How did you do that? Just knock on doors, make friends?
No, I mean, when you were in the village as just a human being walking the street, you naturally would bump into people and talk to people. And at that time, nobody was a somebody. We talked about David just there. David and I are great friends. He never considered himself a somebody. He was just a guy that played music. And practically everybody I knew at that time was the same thing. I know you interviewed Sylvia Tyson. So Ian and Sylvia, I knew them very well. They were just people. They weren't specialty stars of later years, which is great. But at that time, in 66, 67, we were just a bunch of people having a lot of fun, getting along. It was like going to the family picnic every day. That was it.
Yeah.
And nobody was any better than anybody else. We would give each other money or food or clothes or whatever we needed to do to survive. That was basically it. So that's how that all came about. It just so happened that one out of every 25 people became a star, you know?
Yeah, fair enough. But you make a good point because at that time, you didn't really even know that. Everyone was looking for their formula for success and where can we go and what can we do to be successful. But in the meantime, you're all kind of working together. There's the level playing field at that point, I guess.
Right. I have some really good stories about that time period, but I don't think we have time for all of that. Well, some of the people that I met and some of the people I hung out with at that particular time that later on became superstars of Canadian music.
And give me a few. Name a few, like David Clayton Thomas. I mean, obviously they hit really big, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've talked to David or not. Have you?
Haven't. No, I haven't. I'd love to, but I haven't.
Oh, you should. He's in New York. Yeah. We had a place that we sort of hung out at. Everybody, all the hippies that were homeless and penniless and so on. We'd hang out on this church steps. It was an old church. I don't know if you know Toronto very well, but there was a church on Avenue Road in Toronto near Davenport Avenue, which is demolished now. It's a condo. But at that time, it was a church that was only used on Sundays for services. And it has some beautiful steps around. It was a really old century church. And directly across the road from that was a restaurant, a Greek restaurant. And we used to hang out on the steps. And the guys in the Greek restaurant were very nice, very kind people. And they would come out with bowls of French fries and spaghetti and stuff like that to help us out. Yeah. And the musician friends that we sort of developed amongst our community, if you will, used to hang out on a summer night on these steps practically every night, unless you were lucky enough to get a gig somewhere. And so to go to your question, one night I do recall there being on that steps. I actually wrote it down because I thought you might ask me that. There was a couple of my band, the Churls, which you might want to get into later
Absolutely, yeah.
Who else was there, Bill? I don't know. I wrote it down, but I don't know where I wrote it down. Anyway, there was Ian and Sylvia. I know that. David, of course.
Yeah.
Gord Lightfoot was there.
Nice.
John Kay, who was with the Spirals at that time, eventually became Steppenwolf.
Yeah.
And two or three others that I don't recall off the top of my head.
Nice.
But yeah, they were as I say, they weren't like nobodies, but they weren't somebodies either.
Yeah, they're still young guys trying to find their way, right?
Yeah.
They're just trying to see what clicks.
Yeah, and people were playing, don't forget, Dan, at that time, people were playing at these coffee houses and clubs in Yorkville for the door.
Hmm.
And mostly the door was like a buck to get in.
Yeah.
Which was big money. A buck was a buck.
Right.
I mean, most average people were making $35, $40 a week, if you were lucky, in a regular job with a family. So
yeah.
A dollar was, you know, a dollar. And the bands would just play for whatever the door brought in. So if you only had 12 people at night, it was $12 between possibly 5 to 7 to 8 people in the band. And that happened all the time until people got a little better and went on the road, obviously.
But it's interesting to pick up on the point of the community. It seems to me like when you talk about the Village or Greenwich Village in New York or the Echoes from the Canyon down in L.A. and stuff, that there was music sort of emerged from this community spirit or feel.
Right.
I'm not sure what it is. What do you think?
Yeah, exactly. And Hyde Ashbury at the same time. Yeah. And unfortunately or fortunately, whichever way you want to look at it, I guess some of it was related to the drug scene at that time. Which wasn't super heavy, but it was around, and that had crept in from the United States, I believe, and from wherever. So there was always a little tote of marijuana in the air, and I think that eventually helped. Well, I know it helped my bands in some way, shape, or form. They weren't bad, but it helped them think a little differently than the average plumber,
Yeah. Well, again, the community spirit of, you know, the singer-songwriter trying to write songs about your experiences and about the things that are happening in the feel, and then transfer that feel onto the record and then get it out through the airwaves. And it just seems like when you watch Echoes from the Canyon, I think it was, Bob Dylan's son, Jacob Dylan, I think he narrated that, but he talked about that, you know, Stephen Stills and all those guys that lived up in Laurel Canyon and all the songs and the music that emerged from there, or the Village, or again, Greenwich Village. Did you ever go down to New York? Did you ever go to the Greenwich Village?
I didn't go down there. No, I went to Woodstock in 69, but Village, yeah.
I lived in Whitby in 69, but I was too young to go, so I couldn't, but a bunch of the teenagers from our complex where I was, they went. Yeah, and I kept asking, what is this? And they said, oh, it's Woodstock. And I said, oh.
Well, believe it or not, there's a bit of a side story here. Yeah. The lead singer of my band, The Churls, Bob O'Neill, we parted company back in those days, and I hadn't seen him for almost 40 years, you know, a couple of years.
Yeah.
And we eventually got back together, and he lives in Whitby.
Oh, there you go. Interesting.
So I went out there last year and had a whole summer day with him and recorded an interview with him and put it together as a special for the radio show. And it was great to see him after all this time. Of course, neither of us recognized each other.
Yeah, well, that happens. But
we used to have hair.
Yeah, there you go. So I'm curious, so how did you get in? You got into the scene, but how did you get into the actual management part of it? Because everyone has, I guess, different affinities, right? Some people play, some people like that. How did you end up being the band manager?
You really want to know that? You got 5 hours? Okay.
Yeah.
So,
short version.
There's no such thing in my life. The short version is I would wander the streets and go and check out the bands all the time. And I kind of, if you will, became known in the area. That I could get into anywhere. Nobody paid me. I didn't have to charge, you know, whatever you say.
Okay.
You didn't have to pay at the door kind of thing. Everybody knew who I was. And I was just a guy, but I was sort of a nice guy and part of the scene. I went to all the bands and watched Luke and the Apostles and McKenna Mainline, all those guys.
Yeah.
And so I was walking the streets one night. And as I say in my book, which will ultimately be out, people, I was walking down, I believe it was either Hazleton Avenue or Yorkville, I can't remember which, and I heard what I thought was the Rolling Stones. And I thought that because I had the Stones albums. They were out.
Yeah.
The early Stones, that is, you know, Off the Hook and that
Off My Cloud and all that.
I thought, no way. You know, we're in Yorkville Village in Toronto. There's no way the Rolling Stones are here. It's impossible. It just couldn't be. But I thought it was. So that piqued my curiosity. So I walked into this club that you may or may not know called Charlie Brown's. It's a very famous spot in Yorkville. It's just a converted Victorian house, something similar to the one I lived in England. And in the window was this cramped little space and this band playing, which was the Churls. And they sounded absolutely identical. They were doing Mona and stuff like that. And it was just unbelievable. So I have, to give you the quick story, I have no idea what possessed me. At the end of that particular set, I walked up to them and said, hey guys, would you like a manager? And they said, yeah, sure. We shook hands, and that was that. Well, there you go. There's the short version.
Well, you know what? It's a good story because most of those bands weren't really capable of, to be fair, of managing themselves and needed a third person to, like, that person to be in charge of that, right?
Well, on average, they were, I believe, at that time, 18 to 21, I think.
There you go.
Their average age, and I was, what, 3 or 4 years older at that time.
Yeah.
And I had a pretty good schooling, so I was kind of smart. Yeah. Smart ass.
You can figure it out.
I had some sort of skills, you know, as far as organizations and this and that and the other. And all of a sudden, just out of the blue, over that one period of time, that night, that day, the next day, everything came together in a real big hurry. I just settled down and started writing stuff down as to what to do, grabbed the yellow pages, started calling schools and halls and this and that and the other, and said, hey, you guys want a band on Saturday night? I got one for you. So we started off playing for $25 a night and sometimes less, and worked our way through the system that way.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And you need that person working the phones and being the mover and the shaker. So, but I read in here, so they got discovered eventually by the Everly Brothers. Is that right?
Yeah, that took a while. We're talking the discovery in, I would think, fall of 66. I worked with them throughout 67. And that's the time period when the Everly Brothers were in town. And somebody, I guess, had told them about the band being super good. And which they were. They'd progressed really, really well from the moment that I discovered them. And they worked hard. They practiced hard. Yep. And so the Everly Brothers came in to see them at an afternoon matinee one day. I went, wow, you know. Shot back a phone call to New York. Got their management company to send somebody up. And a deal was made where I said, bye, guys. Have a good time. And this management company took them over and took them down to L.A.
Yeah, so
for them to New York first and did a whole round of stuff at Whiskey A Go Go and places like that on tour. And then they ultimately went down to LA to A&M and knocked off a couple of albums. But that wasn't the same band. I must clear this up. Everybody that's got it on the web casts and on the web pages on the internet have got it wrong as to who the band was that made recordings. The recordings that were made at A&M were a different band than what I'm talking about. They had two additional members and one less of the original members. And as many times as I've written letters to everybody I can possibly write to, they will not change their webcasts or their web pages to really say the truth. And that bothers me, I must admit, because the original band were five guys that I knew that were extremely good at what they did. And it became different when the management company out in New York took them over, added people, because they wanted to flesh out the sound, et cetera. And so the guys on the albums that you can go and buy from A&M are not the same band.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you clearing that up. And quite often that gets confused. And then you're a primary source. I mean, you're not, this isn't secondhand information, right? You're your primary source. So you should have some kind of say there. But the other point that you make is an interesting one too, because for those who don't know, quite often in the music business, a manager will take a band to a certain level and then through...
True.
Various other reasons, maybe you got a higher level manager or a record company who has their own guy they like, it switches. And that sounds like that's what happened to you.
Well, it's true in a way, yes. But I did have the aspirations of doing exactly what happened to them in my own time. We were sort of at that point, the cusp of coming out of the Toronto, Ontario region. They were that good that I was almost ready to get them down into the States and do exactly what happened eventually, but the Everly Brothers, being the Everly Brothers, beat me to it. Who's going to argue with them? They were big stars, and it was their management company, and so, you know, the boys wanted to go. Why would they not? This was
fair enough,
you know, of course.
So then
I reluctantly let them go.
Well, you know, good move. I mean, that's it's not that unusual, and that's fair enough. They wanted to go to the next level, and then so they went to New York and did basically the same thing they did in Toronto, right? They hung around there and rubbed shoulders with, well, the list here: Buddy Miles, Van Morrison, Ronnie Wood, Rod Stewart, even Lennon and McCartney, Jimi Hendrix.
That's right.
You're at the big boys now, right?
Yeah, and Hendrix. They were playing with Hendrix.
Wow, crazy.
Yeah, Bob told me some stories that are not printed about some of the nights that they had with folks like Hendrix and so on, you know, after hours type of stuff. But yeah, it was true.
But that's one crazy thing about the music business. Like one day you're just a guy that's, you know, kicking around trying to write some songs. The next thing you know, you know, Jimi Hendrix is on stage with you or yeah. you're in the big leagues at all of a sudden, right?
Yeah. And nobody would ever dream of that when you first, back in 1966, kicking around at Charlie Brown's for free, I might add.
Yeah, there you go.
Just a bunch of soft drinks. There was no booze available.
Yeah.
Just soft drinks were provided and sandwiches. And they were happy to be there in front of people and playing. Everybody loved what they were doing. Fortunately for me, as a side to this whole thing, I did have another band at that time. So yeah. I didn't cry in the soup too much because I was now concentrating on my other band.
Yeah.
And life went on from there, and you may or may not know the story of The Fringe.
Well, I want to ask you about that. Yeah, definitely. But
go ahead.
One thing I wanted to ask you, though, is so did you follow the career of the Churls? And did, like, when they went down to L.A. and they played the Whiskey Go-Go and the Electric Circus, did you follow them or keep track of what they were doing?
No, we had some minor communication along the way, like, how are we doing? Oh, we're doing good. That's about it.
Okay.
We didn't have email in those days, and it was always a telephone call, which to the United States was expensive. So there was very, very little communication. And I pretty much had signed them off to the management company, and that's the way it was. So I really had no control or any say in what they did. So
right.
What was the point? And that's unfortunately what happened. And then in 69, they just disbanded. They were very disgruntled, to tell you the truth, with A&M and the way they were producing their records. And Bob told me this in our private conversation that I had last year with him at his house, that they were very upset at the way the records that you can buy are produced. They didn't like the way they were produced. Mm. And they said to me, and he said honestly to my face, you could have produced it that much better. You're a better engineer. You could have done far better for us. And we sincerely regret having to leave you. But on the spur of the moment, hey, it looks like a good deal. Here comes these guys from New York and the Everly Brothers and Hendrix and why wouldn't you?
Well, anybody? You're also getting the U.S. deal. I mean, most Canadian bands would have killed for a U.S. deal.
Yeah.
They wanted to go down to the States and make
That's
their way.
Right.
But then you realize you're a small fish in a very big pond. And then a lot of guys have shared with me, you know, you get assigned a producer and the record company kind of takes over. So you're a little bit of a meat puppet at that point.
You are.
Doing what they want, right?
Yeah. And that's why David was so lucky by getting down to, you know, front to Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Yeah.
He just was fed up with the music scene.
He
was totally fed up with the SoCan rules and all that nonsense. Mm. And he just said, to hell with this, I'm getting out of here. And that's how that happened.
So they lost their record deal, came back to Toronto. You had no involvement again with them at that point, right?
As most bands do, by that time, they were getting fed up with what was happening with them and the way it was happening. And so they started to bicker about different things, about doing songs different way. Sort of like a Beatles story. You know, everybody wanted to do their own thing and disagreed on the way a song should be made. And no, I don't want to do harmony there. And no, I don't want to do this. So they said, forget about it. We'll just go back to Toronto, maybe do a couple of gigs or not.
Yeah.
And it became or not.
Okay.
So they came back here and disbanded, and that was the end of that.
Yeah.
And everybody went out and did their own thing. Now, Sam Hurry, who became part of them, is out west and still playing.
Okay.
Sam's a nice guy, but he wasn't part of the original Churls, as is depicted on all web pages you can possibly pull up. It's incorrect, people. Don't listen to that.
There you go. Well, good. Well, thanks for correcting the record, and hopefully we'll get straightened out at some point.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is, so you have some original recordings of the Churls before they went? And you're going to try to release those somehow or get those out? You have control of those and you're going to try to use those in some measure?
Yes, Dan. If you have a big bank account, we can talk.
I don't, but I would love to hear it. So you recorded their rehearsals or a live show?
You're not going to hear them, my friend. I'm afraid. They are sealed, signed, and delivered. And only my wife will hear them when I'm in a box.
Wow.
Or do something with them. I don't know. No, I'm trying desperately to find somebody to work with me and engineer them properly because they were very archaic.
Yes, of course.
They were a home recording. And we decided to do them one afternoon. I forced them. I said, hey, you guys, we got to put something down on tape. That's the way it is.
Good idea.
And that was it. And I was the big bus chief. And so we did what we called a stage presentation. in the basement of one of the guy's houses. We did it like we would do on stage. And we knocked off maybe 10 tunes, something like that, including two or three that I wrote along the way, which I knocked off about 30 songs on my own. But they included two of those. Thank you, fellas. That was very nice of you. And so one day, maybe I can make a dollar. You never know.
So it was two-track, like a reel-to-reel, just two-track tape?
No, I'm wrong. I'm sorry. Pardon me. It was not. What I did, if you really want to know, I rented a four-track old German Grundig tape recorder from Long & McQuaid in Toronto. I had connections with Long & McQuaid because that's where we got a lot of equipment most of the time for rental and things like that, and where Newton Garwood worked, who became the organist on the records that the Charles did in L.A.
There you go.
There's that connection. So I rented this thing for the weekend for $20 or something like that, and I actually recorded some live stuff at a show, but it turned out so crappy. I think the tape's gone wherever it's gone. I don't know. But the live stuff in the basement, it's not that bad, really. It just needs to go into an engineer's 24-track board and get tweaked a little bit, you know.
Well, good for you for doing that because, I mean, it's fortuitous, right? I mean, it's history, it's totally it wouldn't have happened had you not done that. It would have been gone.
No, it wouldn't. Yeah. And these have never been heard.
Yeah,
never.
Okay. No, very cool. Well, I'll look forward to that. Hopefully one day they'll be put out there.
Well, talk to your friends.
Yes. Well, there you go. Well, we'll see if somebody's interested, if somebody listening to the podcast is interested and is willing to do it. Somebody can do it. I mean, there's the technology's there to do it. It's just finding the will and the way, right?
Put in $100 a piece times 1,300 people. We got it made.
There we go.
And then I'll let them have it. But I ain't leaving my house until then.
So so the other thing I wanted to ask you about is the genres and the influences, because as you know, probably better as well as anybody, like there was a real mishmash of pop and rock and hippie and psychedelic and protest music, and then the British invasion was in full swing, and the Churls were described by somebody as a garage psych band with blues roots and stuff, and I'm thinking, it's so bizarre. So what's your take on all that? What were you trying to do?
I'd kind of not totally agree with that. I don't even know what the definition of garage is, to be honest with you. They certainly weren't pop, that's for sure. There was nothing off the top 40, although I guess I lied. There is top 40 is the Stones, of course, and the Beatles. They were influenced primarily by Yardbirds, Pretty Things, British imports that I got for them, which is another story because I worked part-time at a record store, so I was able to procure these things for them. Things like that, they were into things that were a little different, semi-psychedelic, but not really out there.
Yeah, it wasn't like acid rock or anything like that you described that, right? It
was nothing far, far out.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Blues Magoo certainly weren't that far out. Procol Harum wasn't that far out.
Oh.
People like that. Well, I guess Procol Harum was because it was an orchestral thing. But generally speaking, bands like the Yardbirds primarily, you know, Jimmy Page and Clapton and all that stuff.
Yeah,
they were pretty heavily influenced by that and did some of their tunes, actually. Well, and they loved the blues stuff and Otis Redding. And I turned them on to John Lee Hooker. In fact, we had him at our apartment one time when he came to town.
Wow.
That's another story that'll take 2 hours. But stuff like that.
No,
so they liked my version of stuff that I introduced to them that they didn't currently know, which was blues, which I loved. I loved the blues, the early blues, the acoustic stuff.
And, well, you can hear lots of influences there. I'm just wondering how they market it because it does sound like the sort of flower power kind of music, the cool tunes.
Yeah.
They're a little heavier, the Hammond, the great bass playing. It's just cool. It's a real 60s vibe, nice vocals. You know, you got to have the harmonies and the good singer.
But like I said before, Dan, that what you're hearing on those records, if you're listening to those two records, they are exactly what you're saying. But those tunes are not what they really were all about live on stage in 1966.
Yeah,
they were not.
Fair enough.
Picture the Stones and their first two or three tours, playing their first two or three albums, 5x5, that one. You know, that was the Churls.
Yeah.
Including Bobby up front on the microphone, doing all the Jagger moves. He could do his legs like twist them into pretzels. I don't know how he did it. But he would jump in the air with the microphone and swing it around. And he would do exactly that. Or, you know, anybody like The Who, the Roger Daltrey, like that sort of stuff. That's what the band was live on stage. And I think that's probably what's in the back of my mind and in my craw when people describe them. Sort of like you just did.
Like the flower power, right? Yeah, fair enough, yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't like that. They were a very raw rock and roll band in the pure sense.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm done.
No, I appreciate that, because that's you were there and you saw them and you know what they were about. And and again, sometimes, you know, I was talking to the guy from the Bells, and they were talking about that too. Like their stage show was a lot more intense and energetic than the songs that you end up getting on the radio.
Exactly.
So it's a bit of a difference there. Yeah. So I just wanted to ask you about the Churls and about the genres and the influences and stuff. Because then you got involved, obviously, with the Fringe then right after that. So how were they, how did you get involved with them, and how were they different? Because they were, you know, had some real hype too, right?
Yes, they did. Well, that's a bit of a different situation, because they came to me. I said earlier that I worked part-time in a record store. And the two gentlemen were fairly older gentlemen, but really dug the scene at the time, and they liked importing a lot of these records that I purchased for the band, which is how I got these pretty things and stuff like that. And so I was working part-time there, and because I was managing the Churls at that time, this young guy came in one day to see me, and he said, "I understand you manage the Churls." I said, "Yeah, okay, I do." He says, "Well, I've got a band called The Fringe. Would you like to manage us?" So being me, I went, "Yeah, okay."
You say yes before you think about it too much.
No, I don't give this any thought. We all sit down with the silk suits and discuss business. We go, "Yeah, okay, what the hell, man? Well, let's do it, you know." Yeah,
cool.
So I didn't even know what they did. He just said, "We got a band called The Fringe. Do you want to manage us?" I said, "Sure, why not?"
Yeah.
So then that developed into another whole plan and a whole new story, where I decided to open an agency and all that kind of stuff, which is a completely different way to go. But that's how I first met them. They came to me.
Okay.
Now, if you want, as part of that similar scenario, also a gentleman called Greg Hambleton, which you may know, was a record producer at Sound Canada in Toronto, and he would come in the store also to pick up records for a band that he was producing at the time called A Passing Fancy.
Hmm.
Jay Telfer, lead singer. I don't know if you know that or not, but there he was. So Greg and I had a couple of conversations along the way, and the fact that he was a record producer went ding.
Yeah.
Because here we go. The Fringe can record. Maybe. How did we get that done? So the long story cut short is that we had a conversation one day, and Greg also was a songwriter as well as a record producer, and a very good one, I might add. And he had written a whole bunch of what you might call, what you just said, flower powery type of songs for the time, the 66, 67 era, very mamas and papas type of stuff, things like that, Scott McKenzie kind of things, go to San Francisco, very much along those lines. So we came to an agreement where he said, I need a band to record my stuff. If your band will record my stuff, I will produce and record your stuff.
Okay.
I went, "Hey, here's a sweet deal." I said, "Okay, are we talking free?" He says, "Yeah, okay." That was the word for me. I'm down with free.
Yeah.
So that was the deal arrangement that we made, that the band would do his stuff based around his production techniques, of course, and in turn he would engineer and so-called with my help our stuff.
Okay,
I said to the boys, "Well, this is the way it's going to go down, guys." And they listened to some of the demo tracks and went, "No. We don't want to do that." I said, "Okay, simple. Do you want to be on a record or not?" "Yeah, we do." I said, "Okie dokie, this is the way it goes."
Yeah.
And that was the way it went.
Well, it's funny, because I was going to ask you about that, because you ended up getting them a deal with Quality Records, right? And that was no small feat. I mean, everybody and their dog would have wanted that, right? So eventually you led them on the path that got them to that, which
with the help of Greg, I must admit. Greg, being the producer, of course, already had some stuff going with the brass at Quality.
Okay.
A couple of the acts that he was recording for other people, not for himself, but he had made that contact already. Quality Records was just starting off more or less at that time into the rock and roll world. They'd been doing other stuff prior to that. And in that 66, 68 time period, they decided to venture forth. And another side story to that was that their first band doing, quote, R&R was the Guess Who.
Oh, there you go.
Ah.
Yeah.
the Guess Who, they put out a recording with a white label, and the record said, Guess Who?
Right.
And that was sent out to the radio stations, and the name ultimately stuck.
Yeah.
So, says I, we can do that. And so me and Greg communally had a discussion, went out to Quality, got together with the brass, and I think it was one of their promo men or something that came up with the idea of, let's do the same thing for the Fringe, where we can put a certain amount of tracks on a blank disc with a white label and just call them something, send it out to all the radio stations that do rock and roll top 40 stuff, and have them do a competition to let their listeners listen to this EP, which had 7 tracks on it, by the way,
right,
and let them vote on what they would like to have as the first single for the Fringe. So that happened.
Oh.
So it was, okay. Did you know that?
I didn't know. Well, I see here that they never actually released an album, but that was an extended play, was longer. Normally EPs were 4, maybe 5 songs. So a 7, right, you know, song EP would have been maybe considered an album, but they never actually released a full album, right?
Well, this is your lucky day because it's just been digitally done. Anyway, that's another story. It's in the works. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
As we speak.
Yeah.
So the 7 tracks out of the, we recorded 11 tracks for the Fringe. That's what we did.
Okay.
Over a period of a few days. I can't remember exactly what the time period was, but we'd be talking 67. Yeah, 67. And so we went into Sound Canada and knocked off these 11 tracks. I think 5 or 6 of them were Greg's, which the boys didn't particularly like, but they did it anyway. They were heroes. And then he recorded our stuff, which of course was more psychedelic because the two boys, John Merkin and Chuck Cadman, were having a little bit of a cigarette issue, which produced some pretty decent stuff, if you've heard it.
So which songs did the radio stations pick of the ones from the EP?
They sent out the 7-track EP and they picked, guess what, Flower Generation, which was Greg's song.
Yeah, and that's super flower power.
All right, whatever. If you've heard the song, you know what I'm talking about.
I've heard it.
No disrespect to Greg whatsoever. No, he's a great guy and a friend of mine. So he knows why.
But it's very 60s. I mean, it's right in the genre, right? Yeah, I mean, he nailed it.
Yeah, San Francisco all the way.
Yeah, for sure.
The flower girl, you know, with flowers in her hair. Da, 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 da. And so the boys didn't want to do that, but that was the only way to go. But on the back of it, we got Token From My Mind, which is what they really wanted out there, and hoped everybody would flip it, which they did.
Right,
but Flower Generation was the one that everybody, primarily out in Western Canada, picked, and that became the A-side of their first record.
Okay, there you go. And then Plastic People, Executive Dream. I saw the TV show clip on that, but Plastic People became, well-known enough, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yep. But then the problem with that was that by that time, Quality was having some sort of issues. I'm not really sure what it was, money problems or whatever. So they only knocked off a few Plastic People, very short run, very, very short. I'm not sure how many exactly, but a very short run.
Yeah.
And so that died off kind of naturally. And then we did a tour out west, which I'd arranged as the manager. I'd arranged the tour and the Let's Go TV show out there.
Yes.
And then we had a big argument, and the boys and I disagreed on a bunch of stuff. And basically, we parted company.
Yeah.
I came back to Toronto. They were going to come back to Toronto to re-record some stuff. And then they had some issues internally, as most bands do.
Yeah.
At some point.
Typical stories here, man.
Yeah, exactly. They all wanted to do something different and whatever. So they, you know, did the best they could for a few weeks, not even more than 2 months, I don't think. I actually had John at my house a couple of months ago. We reunited after 40-odd years.
Wow.
I found him, and we talked on the phone a couple of times. We emailed a couple of times, and he actually made the trip up here to my house where my studio is, and I recorded a great interview with him, which I'm going to produce as a one-hour special at some point.
Oh, very nice.
Great.
Well, the interesting thing is that, so I saw the name Chuck Cadman on there. I live in Surrey, right? And so Chuck Cadman was an MP from Surrey, right? And about 10 minutes from where I live. And the whole story with him and his son, Jesse, being killed and stuff, that's like 10 minutes from where I live.
Yeah.
So I was very familiar. This dad with the long pony, gray ponytail, and he became very prominent on the news because he became, you know, first he was a grieving father, then he became an advocate.
Yes.
and then eventually an MP, and so very well known. And so he's passed away almost 20 years ago now, right?
Yeah, it was cancer. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was your experience with Chuck? He was in
the
band.
Oh, he was great. Yeah, he was a great guy. I got along with all the guys. They were a little headstrong, especially in the studio, because they had their own ideas of how they wanted things done. From their mind, obviously, from the mind to the console is a different story.
Yeah.
And we couldn't quite get some things the way they wanted it, so there was compromise along the way, naturally, like there always is in the production end of things. But we got it done, and I'm quite happy with it. I'm quite proud of them, actually.
No, well, good for you.
And then, I love both of them. I really do.
Well, Chuck was well loved out here. And I mean, you know, the way that his son was killed was completely senseless,
I know,
random nonsense.
Yeah.
That cost a young kid his life. And Chuck was really broken from that. And you know what? He tried his best to advocate for, tougher laws and to become part of the system to try to change it from within. So he was well respected out here. That's all I can say. I saw him lots. So.
And John went on to a really, really good life. And I was amazed when I eventually found him and hooked up with him.
Yeah.
I actually contacted him, I think, through Greg. Greg and I had a coffee one time in downtown Hamilton where I live.
Yeah.
I got a hold of Greg first out of all these different people I've been trying to contact over the years. And then Greg and I connected somehow or other. I don't recall how. But I remember we having a coffee and he said, "Oh, have you talked to John?" I said, "No, I haven't talked to John in like 40 years. And he said, "Well, you know, here's how you can get a hold of him." So I did. And we went from there to what I just told you. So John went on into the world of medicine, which completely blew me away.
Wow.
And now he's like a top brain surgeon or something or other.
Crazy. Wow.
Wild. I just can't envision this guy strumming this guitar on the Let's Go show being a brain surgeon. You know, rocks my world.
Yeah. Really. Well, I guess everyone finds a path. I mean, music is not for everybody. I've been a full-time musician my whole life, but I know lots. And most people get out of it at some point and pursue some other form of life. So that's not unusual, but... I've made a good living for more than 40 years now. It's been since the early 80s.
Good for you.
Very thankful, and I stuck at it, and it's been good. So,
well, I got as far as the piano and the B3, and that was it for me. I tried bass for a while, but it hurt my fingers. So.
Oh, there you go.
So the next best was the thing was to go into radio, and that's on a whole another hour.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you about that. But so just to wrap up on the Fringe thing, there's two things. One is there's some acetate copies out there that I read about quite a bit of that stuff is in demand, or that it's rare. Do you know where that is or what it is?
Yes, I do, Dan. It's about 2 feet away from me in my dresser drawer.
Aha, you have it.
And there it shall stay.
Yes. So is that, so I see that there's a compilation that came out in 2021, Token From My Mind. Did you have any part in that?
No, I didn't. No,
okay.
That was a licensed deal with somebody else and Greg. Greg has the master tapes.
Does he? Okay.
Sessions.
And they're 8-track, would they be?
No, they were done on, it would be an 8-track. Yeah, pardon me. Yeah.
Probably 4 or 8 back in the 60s.
Yes, it was 8, I believe, in the studio. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so he has the masters of those, and therefore he was able to make the deal with this company who is putting a vinyl album out very, very soon.
Okay.
It will be the 11 tracks
and
a booklet, which I have contributed to, and pictures, which I have contributed that nobody else has.
Oh, good.
And it's going to be a really nice piece of material for those to buy. It'll be a collector edition, I'm told. It'll be done on top-grade vinyl with the collector book inside, and a limited edition 500 copies numbered.
Oh, so isn't that nice? Wow.
It's going to be very, very soon.
Very cool.
In fact, I believe the tracks have been mastered already. I don't know what's happening from that point on, but that was done in December, I think.
Okay. Well, very cool. Well, we'll watch for that. And that'd be very interesting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously you had some fun in the music business and you had some frustrations. Did you reach the success level that you wanted personally or for your bands? Or
was no.
Things just can't control the uncontrollables, I guess?
That's right. Yeah. Because I wanted them to be where the Stones are now.
Right.
And to be honest, either of them could be. Not necessarily you and the same thing, but they could have been at that level where they could have filled Wembley Stadium quite easily.
Yeah, okay.
They really could. Well, with the right equipment and the right backing and the right money and all the other things that go to make Wembley Stadium. Yeah, they could have done it. I firmly believe that either of them could have accomplished that if other parties had not got involved and we had gone along the track that I had foreseen for them.
Okay.
And so I was, to answer your question, I was quite disappointed and certainly quite devastated in an emotional way because I could not achieve our dream together because of various outside influences. But, you know, fortunately, they both did well in their own way for a period of time that was their time. That was it.
Well, and also, I mean, keep in mind that for every successful band like the Stones or superstar band, there's 1,000 other bands who are mid-level success. Yeah. You know, they just don't go much farther.
Yeah.
Is there anything you could have done differently? Like looking back, do you think, could you have played it a little differently?
Well, I could have refused the Everly Brothers thing, but I would have probably got crucified by the boys because it was their decision communally.
Right.
That's what they wanted to do. And who am I to hold them back?
Well, fair enough.
It was an opportunity for the Churls to go into the States and do what they did. And so I couldn't get in the way of that. I just couldn't. So that's what
happened. Enough. Yeah, fair enough. And you never see the path you don't take.
No.
Because you don't get to play that out. No. So.
And as far as the Fringe was concerned, after the argument that we had out west, which was just after the Let's Go show, by the way, it was just an internal conflict of what to sing, what to play, what to do, blah, blah, blah. And we had intentions of them coming back to Toronto and talking to Greg and maybe re-recording some stuff, plus other things that they'd written along the way. And then they had internal issues while they were out there and disbanded. Right. And Chuck went down to where you saw him out west. What was it?
We stayed in Surrey. He lived in Surrey.
Surrey, you're right.
Yeah.
And then John came back to Ontario. So.
Okay, well, there you go.
That was that.
So
and then I got an opportunity to get into radio, and that's what
tell
I've
me about
been
that.
Ever since.
Tell me about that. So you sort of took a bit of a left turn. I guess it kind of all culminated. You were in the music business. You worked at a record store. There was nothing there that you weren't familiar with, I'm assuming.
Yeah, no. And the strange thing, I don't think we have time for a complete story, to be honest with you, Dan.
I'll give you the short version. That's okay.
Maybe a part two here. Well, I was DJing between sets with the Churls when they were playing at Charlie Brown's and places like that. With my own 45s, just doing a little, you know, DJ gig in between their sets while they were having a rest. And some guy came in one night from CBC Radio and said, hey, we all dig this rock and roll stuff. CBC's changing its ways. Would you like to come and play some rock and roll music or do some interviews? I said, as usual, I said, yeah. Whatever. I said, anything. I didn't care what it was. It was okay. So the deal was I went to CBC and the guy puts me in a room, just a very small room with a table and a microphone on it. And he says, well, I just want you to talk to this young guy who's made a few records about the music scene in general. I said, yeah, okay, whatever. So in comes this guy, and we sat there and we shot the breeze about certain records that he'd just finished doing, and he was starting on his path of fame and fortune, and that would have been Bobby Cotola.
Wow, there you go.
And that was my very first interview. Little did I know that the microphone cable went through the table, through the floor, into the basement, where all the engineers were putting it out live to the world.
Wow.
On CBC Radio. And that was my radio start.
Crazy. Because you thought it was pre-recorded.
I didn't know what it was. I was just talking to a young guy.
So there you go.
And we became lifelong friends until he passed away.
Oh, good.
We communicated with each other many, many times, and we saw each other many, many times. A great guy.
Well, I know my friend Les Vogt knew him quite well
and
worked with him and helped him lots too. So,
but again, he was just starting off, just done a couple of records. He didn't know where he was going.
Yeah.
We talked about the future possibilities of what could be, what he hoped to be, and this and that and the other. And gee, he was going to play at somebody's school gym one night, and he was all happy about that. And
that's great.
We just talked, just like you and I are doing right now.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about the technical aspect of it, or this thing was going live on CBC Radio, which I guess at that time everybody listened to.
Yeah, and sometimes those create the most magical moments, like the live hits, right? You just got a guy on and you're shooting the breeze, and that's the way it is. But so you stayed in radio. That became your career?
Well, yeah, I did that actually for a few people. I don't recall all the names, but this happened to be a Saturday night thing that they pulled me in because, like I said, it was live across the country. Mm-hmm. So it was, quote, a Saturday night live interview with me. I was just Bill Riley at that time. And whoever showed up, and there was a bunch of other people that became good eventually, that we did that for a while. And then I talked to somebody somewhere at some meeting. This is all pretty hazy stuff. It was a station in Toronto. I think it was CKLH or something like that, that they wanted some guy on the weekend to come and play some music, like a Saturday night, Sunday night type of thing, midnight to six. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And they offered me $25 a night or something. So I did that for a while.
Good for
and
you.
Then I was offered a gig at a hotel on Yonge Street in Toronto to play for the patrons of the hotel in their dining room. They would be dining and I would play sweet soft music, beautiful stuff, you know. Yeah. And I didn't care what it was. It was music and I was getting paid. So what happens? In comes a guy that I had met at this previous radio station, which I think was CKHL, but don't quote me, please. I'm not sure 100%. And he came and said he'd just been invited to be the program director of a brand new station in Burlington, Ontario, that was a Sing, C-I-N-G radio. It was a multicultural thing owned by a company in Toronto, and he was going to be the program director there and change it into a oldies station, which because they just acquired a Canadian license as the very, very first 24-hour oldies license issued in Canada. He was going to be the program director. He liked what I did and what we talked about prior. Would I be interested in coming down there and helping him and a couple of other people that he had reined in to create this oldies radio station, which nobody had ever done before?
Yeah, well, that's
you
great.
Know, people played oldies at lunchtime, that type of thing, for a half an hour or whatever. But nobody had ever done it as a station 24 hours a day with an actual content.
Yeah.
So I went, yeah, sure, what the heck, we did that. So I went down there and spent 10 years at FM 108, and that all turned around into the dance music craze of the late 80s, and I coincidentally was called by somebody else at that particular time that I was leaving, would I mind going to a university and teach radio at McMaster Radio in Hamilton.
Wow.
So I did that for 7 more years, and life went on, you know.
Well, that's cool because you're, you know, I was going to say, like, because your primary source, you grew up in it, you lived it, you worked it, you become a sort of a living historian anyways, in some measure, because you were there.
Well, the beautiful thing about FM 108 was the fact that I could, off the top of my head, go with these intros into particular music because I knew the people.
Yes, there you
know,
go.
Whoever it was on the record, I'd already met them somewhere, maybe at CBC or at a gig or something, and I knew half of these people anyway. And then whilst I was there into 83, 84, Lulu's opened up in Kitchener, which was the biggest nightclub in North America at that time.
Wow.
And FM 108 became the sponsor of that club. And so I would go out there and I would go and interview. I don't want to do a name dropping thing, but literally 100 people. I mean, name them. From James Brown to Supremes, Mary Wells, Freddie Cannon, the Crystals, Supremes, Martha and the Vandellas.
Unreal. Well, that's super exciting. Well, I look forward to your book as well. And then, of course, having worked in a record store makes you somewhat of an expert too. I know it's like a librarian that works in the library.
Yeah.
You touch a lot of stuff. You look at a lot of stuff. And I was going to say too, when you're DJing, people need to be reminded that's back in the day when you had to haul your records around with you too, right? So you'd be hauling crates of records around.
That's right. I had some, I developed a DJ company, and I actually had 9 guys working for me at one time doing weddings and stags and whatever, plus myself. And because I was on FM 108, I was allowed to advertise my disc jockey service.
Oh.
So I was able to do that. They gave me free promos. And so that got me a lot of business. And we were super, super busy. Every Friday, Saturday, sometimes Thursdays, sometimes Sundays. And we did very, very well in those years in the mid-80s as a company. And with
so
all my
you'd
guys.
You'd take 45s, I guess, and then some albums.
Yeah.
How many albums would you take in 45s to a gig?
I didn't take too many albums because I finally got smart and started to pre-record sets on cassette.
Yes,
and
once
so
you can
I would
do that,
take a little recorder with me, plug it into my main unit, and when I wanted to either do a bathroom break or go out on the floor and dance with a young lady, which they often happened to ask about when I was DJing.
Got to be done.
I would, you know, hit the little CD player and it would run 3, 4, 5 records or tunes in a row where I didn't have to go back to the set. So that was pretty cool.
Very
so
good.
That's how I got around that. It was the actual tunes off the actual 45s, but that's the way I got around it.
Yeah,
so that happened. And then FM 108 had a reunion. Somebody contacted me and said, hey, we're going to have a reunion of the boys that used to work back in the day in the 80s before it changed formats. Do you want to come to the reunion? I said, yeah, sure, of course. So we went out to this one DJ's house, and there was maybe 8 or 9 of us that were still alive. Unfortunately, some had passed by that point. Okay. But we were all there, and we all kind of hugged and kissed and all that sort of stuff and got to know each other. And then came the brilliant idea from there that we should try and recreate FM 108. Hmm. Why not? Let's make a tribute station. So, of course, I got elected. Nobody else wanted. Hey, you can do it. You know how to do it. You're a good programmer. You know how to do this thing. You know how to put stuff together. You've got all these interviews. You've got all the music. Yes. And by that time, I had roughly 96,000 records in my basement, which drove my wife crazy. Yeah. When are you going to get rid of that stuff? You know how that is. I had a large, large collection. Let's put it that way. So, yes. So this new internet thing became the thing, you know. So I developed FM. I developed Oldies 108. That was the name we picked. Oldies 108 to represent FM 108.
Okay.
That's how that happened. Oldies108.ca, folks. Tune in anytime. You'll love it. It's 24-hour stream.
That's great. Well, so, I mean, they were correct in saying that you were probably the one that was best equipped. And then you sound like me. Like, I don't like to say no. I like to say yes. Like, even when I when I agreed to do these podcasts and stuff, they said, would you like to do the podcast and introduce some people? And I said, yeah, sure. Yeah, I didn't really know what I'd have to do. But it's really been great because I've talked to some excellent, really interesting people and like yourself and stuff.
And then you got to me.
That's
you can't win them all, Dan.
You know what? I've had some excellent conversations and really, you know, uplifting. And I like hearing people's stories and your story too, you know. And so I usually ask my guests, you know, how do you see the music scene now? And I guess from your perspective, you're old school and I'm old school too. But how do you see the music scene now?
Can I be super honest, or do you want me to tell a story?
No, please be honest.
I don't like it.
Yeah. Okay.
From the minute the rap was first invented, my mind turned off music, period.
No.
I don't see any value in it. Now, on the other hand, there is some pretty good country stuff going on because I have to say that because I have a country station as well, which is a different thing altogether.
Well, there's always good songs that come out. It's just the buzz is not there. I mean, I'm kind of lost in the 70s. I don't have any apologies about that. I love the 70s. I was a teenager in the 70s and that's my music. And I don't care if they ever write another song. I'm good. I got enough to do me. Well,
but there are 108, we go from the 50s to the end of the 70s.
Right.
And the odd time I'll program something that was hot in the 80s. There's not that many that in my mind was hot, but the odd one is like a Billy Idol or something like that.
Yeah.
Just to go with the flow and to create a bit of a break in what we're doing. You can't be flogging Bobby V all day long, you know.
Right. Yeah.
So just for that purpose, if anybody listens to the station, I think they'll like the flow of the stream. It does change up. I've got interview pieces in there. I've got nice promos in there. And people with their own IDs. Hi, this is David Clayton Thomas, and you're listening to
all that's one great.
Of, you know, that kind of stuff. So the normal thing.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, I'm not a fan of the latest music. I don't tune into it in any way, shape, or form, mostly because I'm too busy programming what we're doing. But I do have a country station, and some of that stuff's pretty good. We do the old and the new, a nice mixture with, again, promos and this and that and the other. What else?
Yeah, no, well, some of the new country stuff is sort of country rock, 70s-ish country rock.
Yeah. Too.
Good melodies, good singing, nice harmonies. Yeah.
You know, the Garth Brooks stuff's pretty good, and things like that. Alan Jackson's. That's kind of what we do on the country station. We mix it up a little bit, just like the oldie station. But the guys I've got, there's 8 of the guys from the original FM 108 that are still alive. And they came into the studio when we first started. This is our 5th year coming up on Canada Day. They all came in and did a whole whack of promos for me that I'd written. And
I've
still got those and we use them. And then occasionally I call upon them to come on in and do another session with me. And we do a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
I program all that. So there we go.
Two questions that I often ask my guests, that I almost always ask my guests. One is, how much of what you did and what you experienced was a function of the time that you did it in?
Absolutely.
The time in history, right?
Absolutely. All of it.
Yeah.
All of it. I was immersed in it 110%. Without being there at that time and doing what we did at that time, I would probably have become a carpenter. I don't know.
Right.
Something. Yeah. But I definitely wouldn't have gone and sat in an office for 9 hours.
Yeah.
With a suit on.
And that was
I don't even own a suit.
No, not even one.
She says, "You know what? You're getting older. You may have to go to a few funerals." I said, "Don't talk like that. Yeah. You should think in terms of getting a suit." I said, "The only suit I'm going to be getting will be on me, baby."
Yeah, there you go.
What a way to end a podcast, eh?
Well, so another quick one though about the songs and about the music that came out at that time. You know, I often ask my guests, could there ever be another Beatles? Do you think there could ever be another band that really changes the musical landscape?
No.
In the way that were Beatles?
No. It wasn't just their music. It was everything that they did in their dress, in their style, presentation, and the way they did the things that they did. There will never be anybody that can do that again. Yeah. Because first of all, I don't believe there are four individual musicians that were as close as they were through growing up together in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
I mean, they all came from Liverpool, you know, and they all came from the same place. So they talk the same way. They talk kind of funny. So that was it. And so you've got to have like four guys from the same town doing the same thing all the time.
Crazy.
They know each other since they were babies.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Just in my opinion.
Well, and I tend to agree. And the melodies that emerged from those guys,
sure.
I mean, it's just,
sure.
I just can't see that being replicated. It's possible, I suppose. But so it sounds
the first
like
thing I heard was Love Me Do. And I was in the garage at one time with my car and I heard it come on the radio, the local radio, and it was Love Me Do. And
yeah.
What the heck is that?
That's great. I mean,
who's going to do a song like Love Me Do? Nobody.
Well, wasn't their first North American hit Please Please Me?
It was, but the first one I heard was Love Me Do.
Yeah, because I remember that too. It sounded so beautiful.
And then I want to hold your hand and all that.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. No, that's good. Well, it sounds like your journey took you to a happy place. You're in a happy place in life?
I definitely am in a happy place. I've been with the same lady for a very, very long time.
Good for you. Yeah.
Very long time.
Yes.
And all things are good. And I'm just living the dream because I'm programming three radio stations every day. I'm talking to people like yourself about different things in various ways. Some of the material is going to be coming out, like I said, very shortly. The stuff I'm hanging on to, if I can find somebody to sponsor that or work with me on that or anybody you happen to know, that'd be great.
Yeah. Okay.
And we can get something done with these unreleased things before I'm not in a position to do that.
There you go. So you got a book in the works. You got these recordings that you want to, you know, get out there somehow, some way, somehow.
Yeah.
And you're still doing the radio oldies and you're doing the radio station. So you got lots going on. The future looks bright for you.
Well, whatever future there is,
Well,
absolutely. My doctor appointments are getting a little more frequent.
Yeah.
But other than that, I live life happily. I'm just glad to wake up in the morning and see the ceiling. It's a good feeling.
Yes, well.
How can you go wrong?
I
don't have any regrets. If that's the question, I don't have any regrets about anything or any of the things that I thought of in the time. I would not have changed that time period of my life for anything. I met so many great people. So many people that I've personally interviewed, like you are with me, and my recordings are here on tape, and they're never going to be heard, some of them, but some are, and some have been. But I met some wonderful people who are now gone, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned, James Brown and people of that ilk, they're gone. But Etta James was another one that I interviewed for 2 hours. I have people like that on tape that some people I've never got. The way they talked to me was on a one-on-one basis, like you and I. It wasn't formal. It was just two people talking.
Yeah.
And so I cherish them with everything that I have.
Yes,
and I hope that at some point, somebody somewhere can help get this stuff out there in some form. So there we go.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And again, you made a historical record because you spoke to people who can not speak anymore. So good for you. So who of all those people you interviewed, who stood you on your head or really impressed you the most?
Off the top of my head, it would be James Brown. And the reason for that would be real quick. I waited 6 hours to see him because his flunkies wouldn't let me go anywhere near him.
Wow.
He knew from the people involved with the club that I was waiting to talk to him. And he got tied up with doing other things. Other people came in and did this, that, and the other. But his entourage, let me not call them flunkies, that's not nice. His entourage barred me at every step. And I sat around for 6 hours. When I finally got an opportunity to get to him, he said, "Oh, you just got here?" I said, "No, I've been waiting 6 hours." And he went ballistic on his entourage. He reamed them out like you would not believe.
Wow.
He made words up that I didn't even know. And then we went in the room and we did our thing. I have some great promos from him.
Very nice.
Where he screeches and says, "Hey, this is Wild Bill on the radio. And this is James Brown. He's my man." Things like that.
Oh, nice.
I cherish that stuff.
Oh,
I cherish
it. Cool. Well, great. So, well, yeah, it sounds like we just scratched the surface. People are going to have to read your book to get some of the more elongated versions of the stories and get the deeper
part story. Part 2, part 10, yes. Whatever.
Sure. No, that sounds great too. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time and talking to me today.
My pleasure.
Many thanks to my guest, Wild Bill, Bill O'Reilly, for being part of the Liner Notes podcast and sharing some insights of his many musical adventures and accomplishments over the years. As we said earlier, the website is oldies108.ca. Check it out. We hope you enjoyed the podcast and invite you to subscribe to it and share it on social media so others can enjoy it as well. And we also invite you to listen to Dusty Discs Radio Tuesdays and Thursdays to hear music from the Canadian artists you're hearing on this show. So until next time, I'm Dan Hare.